Fangoria presents Class of 80.
It's exactly 12 minutes after midnight, and this is Stevie Wayne, your nightlight, around until about 1 o'clock. I'm high tonight in the KAB Lighthouse on Spivey Point, and in case you've forgotten, it's April 21st, and a happy birthday for Antonio Day. Now, there's a celebration planned for tonight, so if you're so excited about it you can't sleep, well, stay up with me, and I'll figure out some way to keep you occupied.
Class is back in session. Hi, my name is Natasha Pacetta, and I'm the vanguard of the vault at Fangoria. And welcome to Season 2 of Class Of, where we are celebrating and looking back at our favorite horror movies from 1980 and 1990. You'll hear from the cast and crew directly about their experiences making the movies that filled the pages of the original run of Fangoria magazine. Return to Antonio Bay with our first Class of 80 series on John Carpenter's The Fog. Stevie Wayne herself, Adrienne Barbeau, kicks off this two-part series. Adrienne finally remembers the beautiful filming locations, tackling the stairs at the Point Reyes Lighthouse, the inspiration behind Stevie Wayne's voice, working with the smelly fake fog, and much more. Before we get to Adrienne, I want to tell you about our series sponsor, Froggy's Fog. From Hollywood, Universal Studios, haunted houses, to your own backyard, Froggy's Fog has all your spooky effects needs covered. Froggy's manufactures theatrical fluids right here in the USA, so no need to risk shipping them on the Elizabeth Dane. It is never imported. Their theatrical fluids use pharmaceutical-grade chemicals, much better for you than the fog in Antonio Bay, and has more active ingredients in their formulas, causing less wear and tear on your machine, as well as giving you more bang for the buck. So whether it is a professional fog machine, sense to tie a scene together, or their immersive DIY laser swamp kit, Froggy's Fog is your one-stop shop for all things theatrical effects, even fog-filled bubbles. And in this time of uncertainty, Froggy's has also started producing hand sanitizer to help combat the COVID-19 pandemic. Visit froggiesfog.com for more information. And I want to tell you about Fangoria.com. Fangoria is offering a free 2-month digital membership to everyone. Go to Fangoria.com for more information and to make your account. Then pore over all the exclusive articles, interviews, and reviews on the site, as well as original video content and all the podcasts you could ever want. You'll even have access to high-resolution scans of the original run of Fangoria magazine. Go to Fangoria.com now to start your free digital membership. And if you're looking to add to your watch list, Fangoria's latest movie, VFW, is now available to stream on demand, and Satanic Panic and Puppet Master The Littlest Reich are streaming on Shudder. Now let's hear from the legendary Adrienne Barbeau, because class is officially in session. Ahoy, Métis! We have a wonderful guest for you today. Adrienne Barbeau joins us to share her memories of making The Fog. Thanks so much for joining us, Adrienne.
I've been looking forward to it.
We love The Fog here at Fangoria, of course, and I can't believe this year marks the 40th anniversary of this amazing movie, and you were just so integral to the legacy of this film as Stevie Wayne. And I think let's just start there at the development of the character Stevie Wayne. I know you had worked with John Carpenter before on Someone's Watching Me, and then he wrote this character for you. So talk a little bit about, you know, what you thought of the character when you first read the script.
Well, when I first read the script, I was bemused, let's say, because I had no experience with the genre. I never watched horror films, or I don't know that this is really a horror film. It's more like a ghost story, I guess.
Right.
But I didn't watch ghost stories either. And I was heavily into the women's movement. And this wasn't the China syndrome. It wasn't, coming home. It wasn't any of the socially significant movies that I was going to see. And I thought, well, oh, okay, well, but she's a wonderful character, and I love the character. And then, of course, as I became more familiar with it and we started to work on it, I mean, it's one of my favorites and one of the ones that I am most proud of.
Yeah, and Stevie is such a strong character. She's an independent woman out on her own. She owns her own radio station, and she's pretty much the sole DJ, and she seems to be working as a single mom too, and she just kicks butt in this movie. She really does, and we'll get into the ending scene that culminates in this movie with your character in a bit. But that's really interesting that it was very different from what you were used to going to see and what you were interested in. But it kind of, her character, I think, kind of fits into that female empowerment movement, actually. Did you model Stevie Wayne's voice off of anyone? I think I heard you mention Allison Steele in a couple interviews, but talk a little bit about creating that voice.
I was in New York from 65 until 72. And I believe, you know, at that time that there was a disc jockey on one of the, it would have been AM stations probably in those days, maybe FM, I'm not sure, named Allison Steele. And I seem to remember that she sort of introduced herself as the Nightbird. And she had a very distinctive, soothing, lower register voice, you know, the Nightbird. And so I'm sure I had that in my mind when I started working on Stevie.
Yeah, definitely. And it's such a memorable voice. It really is throughout the whole horror genre, of course. And what was there something that you had in the back of your mind that you really wanted to bring to the Stevie character that may have not been on the page initially?
No, I don't think so. I mean, John knew me. He knew the kind of characters I played. The strange thing about the voice is that, you know, for 6 years prior to doing The Fog, I was on Maud,
right,
working with B. Arthur, who had a very low voice. And I always thought my voice sounded squeaky, and you know, I hated my voice. And maybe it was just in relation to B or whatever, or maybe it was just as I, you know, I started out, you know, on Broadway playing. Well, I was Fiddler's middle daughter in the Broadway production of Fiddler on the Roof, and of course, you know, a young teenage girl, and then even on to Grease, where I did use more of the bass in my voice. But I grew up as a lyric soprano, and it's only been, you know, maybe in the last 40 years that the voice has dropped and that I like it. When I go back and watch some of the early Maud episodes, it's like, oh my God, what is that voice? So maybe it was, so certainly Stevie took me into another aspect of my voice, that's for sure. But John knew me. He had cast me in Someone's Watching Me because of the role I played on Maud, which was a strong woman, the kind of character that he liked to write, the Howard Hawks woman.
Yeah,
you know, Lauren Bacall and Katherine Hepburn. I mean, women who had some strength and power and who were not pushovers.
Right.
So she was all on the page. And so the only time we ever had even a disagreement about the character was we were getting ready to film, I think it was the scene right after the Driftwood catches fire, right after that, where I put it out or whatever. And John said, okay, sit down, let's get started. And I said, sit down? Oh, John, I don't think she'd sit down. She's too nervous. She's too, you know, upset about what just happened. And he said, okay, stand up and let's get started. And that was the only time, you know. I mean, he's an incredible director, and I certainly, you know, trust him 125%, if not 200%. So had he wanted anything from me that I didn't think was right, I probably would have gone with him anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing that, you know, you had such great direction at the character. And of course, he knew you and knew how you would play Stevie, of course. And that's really cool to hear. And of course, yeah, if something is catching fire that shouldn't, that's supernatural, you probably would be standing up. So,
yes.
I think it's really interesting how they shot most of the Stevie Wayne and KAB scenes on a soundstage, and you're pretty much alone for most of those scenes and kind of isolate it from the rest of the movie. It's kind of like you're almost the narrator in this movie. You know, everything comes together at the end. But what was it like filming those scenes kind of, you know, away from the rest of the movie?
You know, I don't, everybody has always talked about that since the movie came out and everything. I don't remember even truly being aware of it. I mean, I had the microphone. A lot of what I was doing was directed to the microphone, to my audience, to the people out there, to the people aboard the ship.
Right.
I never thought about it. I don't remember ever thinking, oh, I'm all by myself in all of these scenes. It never crossed my mind.
That's good. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just always thought it was really cool the way they shot the interior of KAB with you, because, you know, Dean Cundey is so amazing, and just the how they replicated the light, you know, going around in a circular motion and it hits your face, and, you know, it just makes everything so beautiful. And of course, you also did scenes at the real Point Reyes Lighthouse. Talk about what that was like, because those stairs looked brutal.
Plus, I was wearing 3-inch platform boots.
Oh my gosh, no way.
It is such a beautiful part of the country. I think it's one of the most gorgeous locations in the United States. So it was a joy to be up there. In fact, when the movie was over, John and I bought a house up there Inverness. We shot in the lighthouse itself is the Point Reyes National Seashore, and then the shots of the gas station and Stevie's house, all of that, those were in the town of Inverness, which is the next town over from Point Reyes.
Mm.
It was just a joy to be there. As far as the stairs went, it's the lighthouse is operated by the National Park Service. If it got too windy and there was a cutoff, I don't remember how many knots per mile or knots per minute or whatever it was that then they had to shut us down and we weren't allowed to film. So there were a couple of days when we were all set to go out there and, you know, we're going to have to shoot someplace else because we can't even get, we can't get to the property.
Oh, man. That's working with the natural elements. That's always tricky.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was, it's one of my favorite photos. A fan took a gorgeous shot of the lighthouse in the fog and gave it to me at a convention sometime in the last 3 or 4 years. And I had it framed. And
oh, man.
I look at it every day with great joy.
It is a beautiful, beautiful area for sure. You know, speaking of natural elements and unnatural elements, like the fog is a main character in this movie. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like working with the real and also the fabricated fog that they had to make?
The fabricated fog, we called it fog juice, was some kind of combination of kerosene and oil, and it was god awful. It smelled. It was greasy. It was not fun. But this was in the days before CGI, thank heavens.
Yeah.
And the other thing that was difficult was it had a mind of its own. They couldn't do much with it except shoot it into a scene. They couldn't evacuate it from a scene. So as I'm sure you probably read at some point, when time came for me to do the scene on top of the lighthouse where I am surrounded by fog and then something happens off screen, you know, Deus Ex Machina, Hal Holbrook and the ghost are fighting over the gold, and suddenly the threat to me on top of the lighthouse disappears. The fog disappears. Well, there was no way to do that. They couldn't have me surrounded by fog and then have the fog sucked out because they didn't have any way to suck it out.
Right, yeah.
So we had to shoot the film, the scene, in reverse. We had to shoot it in reverse with me being, with there not being any fog and me being, you know, astonished and surprised and relieved that I'm not in jeopardy. And then acting it backwards. I don't know. You can figure it out. I talk about it in my book, but and I'm much more clear in my explanation in my memoir. But
yeah, no, that's
you
a
sort of get the idea.
Oh, definitely. Like you're acting backwards, essentially.
Yes.
And that's
yes.
such a hard thing to do, especially.
And then I guess when they developed the film, they developed it upside down, or
yeah.
you know. Topsy-turvy, however they did it.
it's truly amazing. It's amazing that John and Dean and you made that come together and did it in such a backwards, upside-down fashion and that it still worked at the end of the day, which is just a testament to you guys and everyone you know involved in making this movie because you're right, it was before CGI and yes, CGI probably it would have been easier to do, but it just looks so good. It just the fog looks great. The reactions look great from you guys. And, you know, it really is a testament to this movie about, you know, the lengths you went to make this sell the illusion, basically, to the
yeah.
audience. When was the first time you saw the fog in its entirety after you guys had wrapped and everything had been done? And what did you think of it?
I remember we saw, John showed us a first cut. There were just a few of us. And somewhere in the middle of the screening, he asked me to go outside. And we went outside and he said, this doesn't work. It's not working. I don't know if I can direct again.
Oh,
you know,
no.
This isn't working. And I didn't know what he was talking about. But he felt that it wasn't scary enough or it wasn't disturbing enough or frightening enough, I guess, you know. Mm. And so he went back and he went to the studio and he said, look, I need to do some more filming. I need to add some more scenes. And I think he even said that he would pay for it himself. And AFCO Embassy said, no, we this is all secondhand coming from me. I'm sure John has talked about it, but AFCO Embassy gave him the budget and he went back and added, you know, some more scenes. And then I think this may have been the film that we premiered in Phoenix at the Arizona Biltmore, if I remember correctly. I remember being there. I mean, I love the movie, you know, so, but I don't remember a specific experience of seeing it for the first time, except for that early cut.
That's really interesting. You know, that takes a lot to look at your finished product and be like, it's not exactly what I want. Good for John for knowing, you know, what he wanted. And he was humble enough to be like, look, I need to do something else. I need to do more with this movie. And you know, thankfully that is the movie that we have today, and it is very scary, especially the ending, I think. Do you have any other memories of making The Fog that you would want to share with the Fangoria audience?
You know, most of my memories are, I mean, we had such a great time. It was a real family affair. John was working with the crew that he'd worked with forever up until then, and being in that location, It was just a fantastic, wonderful experience.
It's just great to hear that it seemed like a really great experience making this wonderful film. And, you know, it's has a legacy, you know, it turns 40 this year. And I wanted to know if you had any thoughts on why The Fog is still captivating audiences after 40 years.
People come up to me all the time and say it's my favorite film. I watch it once a month. I mean, there's a man, at least one man, I think maybe two out there, who uses it as his clock radio at night to put him to sleep. He just puts it on every night, and I guess he sets his TV. His TV must have some kind of a timer that he can shut it off after a few minutes. and it lulls him to sleep.
Wow.
That's not what we wanted to do with the entire audience, but they love the movie.
They do, and we love it here at Fangoria, and it's such a moody, atmospheric, classic ghost story that will continue to live on and capture audiences.
And with characters that you care about.
Yes.
And that you know, that
yes.
are developed.
They're very human.
You know, it's
human.
Not one of these where within the first 8 minutes of the film, somebody's getting sliced up and, you know.
Right.
Plus, it's... If you really look at it carefully, you know, John's philosophy in those days, as a director, I think, was that the imagination is much more powerful than the visual on screen. And so, I mean, you don't see a lot of, you're not seeing, it's not a slasher, you know?
No. No, I think that's its power. You know, it stood out in that early 80s time of where slashers were becoming huge. And it offers something, like you said, it offers these human characters that you can relate to and you like and you want them to succeed. And it just has something, like it makes your imagination fill in the gaps. And I think that is always going to be more powerful than any slasher movie. So just a wonderful film, and I'm so grateful to talk to you today and have you share your memories with us of the making of this wonderful movie and of, you know, your development and your acting and you just bring Stevie Wayne to life every time I put on the fog. So just thank you so much, Adrian. And we'd love to know if you're working on any projects right now that you want to tell us about or that you're excited about. We'd love to hear that.
Oh, yes, of course. There's a new Netflix series called AJ and the Queen, starring RuPaul.
Oh.
And I had the great pleasure of viewing the third episode. I like the character a lot, and I loved working with Ru, and I think that the series is quite charming. I have another film coming out called The Eagle and the Albatross, starring Dan Lauria. I'm just doing a cameo, but Dan he won the award for Best Actor for that film. Mm-hmm. Got another one that's in post-production with Mark Lucas called Unearth. That's for the Fangoria fans.
Oh, cool.
Looking forward to seeing that one. Just had a film released, about 4 months ago, that's become a big success in Europe. I got to work with Ray Wise again after all these years.
Wow.
That one is called Chain of Death.
Ooh, that sounds cool.
And I've got a couple of other things coming up that I can't talk about.
Well, we loved you in Shudder's Creepshow. That was
really fun
to see you in. Will you be back for season 2? Are there talks of that at all?
Well, it doesn't seem likely, seeing as how, you know, unless they're going to bring the character back, and that I can't imagine.
Yeah, I think she died.
The whole country, the whole world dies in about 4 days or something. But I'm happy to go back.
That was a real treat for us. It really was to see you back in the Creepshow franchise. So we really, really liked that. And I know the Fangoria audience was like, oh my gosh, Adrian's back in Creepshow. And to be the first episode was really cool.
And I also was in the Swamp Thing franchise.
That's
but
right.
Unfortunately, the streaming service.
I know. That was a
sort of came and went.
Whole thing there.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're excited for anything and everything that you're in. We want more Adrian Barbeau in 2020,
well,
that's for sure.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Adrian, for taking the time to chat with me today. It was so lovely to talk with you. You are just so amazing and just a true treat for me as a fan to chat with you and talk about The Fog with you. So thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Class Class Of is a Fangoria Podcast Network original, hosted, edited, and produced by Natasha Pacetta. Executive producers Dallas Sanye and Phil Nobiel Jr. Associate producer Jessica Safa-Vamer. Music by James Malone. Art and design by Ashley Detmering. For Fangoria, Brendan Wynardi and Jason Koslerich. With special thanks to Tom Savini.